Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Justine, I'm going to make you happy today.
Oh, good. I can't wait.
I have a few things to talk about, but it's not going to be nearly as long as it has been the past few weeks. I won't be taking up a bunch of your time.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that makes you happy. Or we'll see when it's over, and maybe I am going to take longer. Maybe I will take longer than I planned on taking.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you say you're not going to take longer, and you leave me a bunch of time, and I'm like, oh, wait, I only have a short recommendation this week. So, you know.
I'll at least give you a minute and a half.
Okay. All right. A minute and a half. I can do it.
And you can just say, I liked this book. And that's enough.
Yes.
Okay. I want to remind people that if they'd like to help us out, we're not trying to make money on this show, but if they'd like to help pay for it, it's really easy. We use Buy Me a Cup of Coffee, and there is a link in the show notes and also on the website. You just click that, and you can make a one-time donation.
Right.
I think I checked yesterday and I don't remember, but I think.
You checked yesterday and you already forgot, huh?
Yes, yes. Hubby's on vacation this week, so my whole regime is off. But I think there is an option.
You can't blame pandemic brain anymore, you know?
No, no,
it's
not
been
pandemic.
A little late brain. in the season here.
No, having Hubby at home has just thrown my whole schedule off. But I do think there's an option if they want to donate a buck every month, it automatically does that. But no, just if you want to go in and leave a tip, that's fine. That would be very much appreciated.
Yes.
And the other thing is, I wanted to wait until the contest was over, which was the contest to leave a review to win a $50 gift card. And I wanted to wait a few weeks because it takes time for those to populate.
Yeah.
Apple can, sometimes they'll show up in an hour and sometimes it takes forever to show up.
Yep.
Well, I have the list of names.
Thank goodness.
Yes. And I am on an online random picker wheel is what it's called.
Okay. All right.
I put the names on the wheel. Unfortunately, I don't think you'll hear it spin.
You can put the spinning noise in.
Okay. I'll put the spinning sound effect noise in. Okay.
Okay.
Oh, I shouldn't say that because people think it's a real wheel. But anyway.
Yeah, we're really like exposing all the secrets today. You can't remember.
Well,
I have short reviews sometimes.
In all honesty, the awkward questions authors get, I do randomly pull those out of a bag, but that hearing paper scruffling isn't nearly as fun as hearing a wheel spin.
No, that's really a lot of fun.
So the wheel will stay. So maybe I'll stick it in after I do this, but let me do the online wheel spin here.
Okay.
And we'll see. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Spin the wheel. And the person's name is Greg. I have Greg's email address. I will let Greg know that he gets a $50 gift card.
Wonderful.
And thank you to everybody that left a review. And I want to thank a lot more people than those that just left a review. Since we've been asking for reviews, we didn't get as many as we anticipated, but there have been a large number that went in and at least gave us a star.
Yeah.
So I know writing a review can be a hassle. If you can do it, that's wonderful. But if you just want to go and leave a star, at least do that. So I'm pretty happy with how that turned out.
Yeah, it helps us in our podcast rankings.
Yes. Exactly.
Maybe we'll get out of, like, you know, being the top 5,000 at some point soon.
Yes. Or maybe we'll reach number one in Romania instead of being in the top five.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. They love us in Romania. Okay.
That's right.
So Greg, I will get in touch with you and see about getting you your gift card.
So do we ever hear how much Lambda Literary Queer Noir raised?
Oh, I'm glad you brought it up. Yes, I meant to bring it up last week and I forgot. I'm forgetting everything these days.
Yeah, yeah.
Queer Noir.
A long vacation for Hubby, huh?
Yes. Yes. It's been wonderful to have him home for the week. It's been a long week. not that I don't love him, but you know, your whole schedule gets thrown off.
That's right.
Yes, I did check, and Lambda made exactly $1,000.
Cool. Wonderful.
Yeah, so this was Queer Noir at the Bar, where different authors read a few weeks ago, and you were able to watch it, and people just made donations. $1,000, it was easy money. So if any of our folks out there made a donation, thank you very much. If you didn't, you can always go to their website and leave a donation.
Okay.
Okay. And I think I've got a bunch of personal notes scrambled in here with my other notes.
What are our upcoming interviews?
Oh, thank you. That is a question. That is what I had written down. See, what would I do without you having around?
I just like encouraging you to speak more so I can complain later.
I have upcoming guest names right next to employer W-2 forms. So
that's good.
That's why I'm having a hard time finding these.
Okay.
Okay. Upcoming guests are J.B. Sanders, Bill Price Talk, Marco Carocari. he spelled it out phonetically for me. So let me try again. Marco Carocari.
Yeah. Okay.
And Michael Nava.
Good.
And Joseph DeMarco.
Wonderful. And today you have Jack Dixon, Avery Queer Tales published author.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Jack is charming. I don't know if I'm going to call the names out every week, because all you got to do is go to the website and there's a button for upcoming guests. So you can do that. I may give you a few each week, but I don't need to run down the whole list.
That's right.
Remember, they're not necessarily in that order, because sometimes we record in advance and they want the show to come out when their book is going to come out. But those are the ones that are coming up soon.
Terrific.
Okay. And I think I crossed that off the list. And I think everything else by Milk, all that other stuff, is my personal stuff.
Okay.
Okay.
By Milk's not the name of a book. You sure?
No, it's not the name of the book. And I don't actually buy milk. It's by oat milk.
Okay.
That's tastier than almond milk, even though there's not really much protein or vitamins. But anyway, I think the rest of the time is for you.
That sounds great. Okay, so I have Posted to Death by Dean James, and it is the first entry in his Simon Kirby Jones mystery series. Simon Kirby Jones is a vampire, and he takes little white pills to do away with the more unsavory aspects of being a vampire. He no longer has to feed on blood. He can go out in the light. He can see his reflection in the mirror, although I think that some of what he talks about are just myths. He said that he can always see his reflection in the mirror, and he could always go into a church and look at crosses and the like. But he doesn't feed on blood. He can go out in the daylight. He's still sensitive to garlic. His senses aren't as strong, but he can still, if he focuses, he can still see pretty far. And he can still hear very well. And so when he is investigating a mystery, he uses those to his advantage. He has...
I'm surprised the garlic part is true. I thought that would be a myth.
Yes, well, you know, when you need to leave clues laying around, you need to have some of those things pop up.
Well, that's true. And I also want to say, I'm disappointed about the pill thing. And you want to know why?
Why?
Because he doesn't have to draw blood if he takes the pill. And I'm thinking of Interview with a Vampire.
Yes.
And I really like the idea of Brad Pitt sucking on my neck.
Well, you know, Brad Pitt may not be taking those little white pills.
In my dreams, he is not.
Okay. Right.
On with the book.
As I, you know, recombobulate myself now.
I've got Brad Pitt on the mind, so go on.
So, you know, he is recently turned, and the man who turned him in, he had an affair with, and apparently it ended somewhat awkwardly, and I'm not really sure how. He doesn't quite explain it, but his former lover has given him a cottage in the English countryside. So he arrives in this little English village, and this is a traditional cozy mystery. He joins the fundraising committee for the church, and they're going to fundraise by having the local drama society put on a play. And the various characters in the village are the disheveled postmistress, the gay bookshop owner, the vicar and his wife, the woman who married into money and a title, who is convinced that she's better than everybody else, and talks about how people ought to treat their betters with respect. Her son and the local rich couple who live in a castle since their retirement, and the English colonel who speaks as many English colonels do. And that's your cast of characters.
And it's a cozy mystery with vampires?
Yeah, yeah.
I like that. That's very original.
It is.
At least to me it is.
And you know, some of the reviews talk about how disappointing it is that he isn't really a vampire because he's got these little white pills. But really, as you go along, him being a vampire becomes more and more important to the mystery.
So it's a part of the story. It's important to the story.
It's part of the story, and it's part of the story, yes.
Okay.
One of the members of the group, the Drama Society group, suggests that they put on a play that clearly she's written, but she keeps being coy about somebody has written, about drama in a small town and how it exposes all the small town secrets. And everybody is visibly uncomfortable. So everybody's got a secret. Everybody doesn't want this to come out. And, you know, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that she ends up getting murdered and absolutely everybody else in the village is a suspect. And it's, you know, your typical mystery as you go along. And he has the woman next door who is also a vampire join him in their investigations. So they end up going and coming up with some cover story to go and interview all the various people in the town and get their stories and figure out where they were and how they were. And each person becomes a suspect, doesn't become a suspect. And the book goes along quite merrily. I thought I had figured it out. I thought it was so obvious that even though I try not to figure these things out, I could figure it out. And then it turns out I was just wrong. So that's part of why I don't try to figure things out, because I often get them wrong and I'm embarrassed by how stupid I was. But it was a twist and all the clues come together and there's no loose ends. The things you thought pointed somewhere else actually did point to the actual killer. And he ends up in a bit of jeopardy along the way. Killer goes after him. And it's got all those elements. It hits all the notes. It hits the notes of the various people in town, how everybody's a suspect, and there's a closed circle of suspects. He describes the little English town in charming ways. He's very good at striking up conversations. All of the supporting characters are very well drawn. They fall in the typical stereotypes, but they're all original and unique. You couldn't just pull it off the shelf and plug in Colonel Plum in the library with the candlestick. It's all far more developed than that.
I want to clarify, not only is it a cozy with vampires, but the vampire is the sleuth?
Yes.
Oh, what fun.
It's a grand time. It's a grand time. And then the son of the woman with money and title ends up working as his secretary. And they have a bit of a flirtation. And by the end, they're not in a relationship. But it's pretty clear that as the series goes on, they will definitely be in a relationship. Oh, and he's also an historian who writes not only historical biographies. Primarily, the one they discuss in it is the biography of Eleanor of Aquitaine. But he also has a pen name under which he writes PI mysteries. And then he's got another pen name on which he writes romantic mysteries. And he's quite successful as a writer. So there's a lot going on in it.
And he is again?
Dean James.
And Posted to Death is the book?
And it's the first in the series of the Simon Kirby Jones mysteries.
Wonderful. And he's actually active in the Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook.
Yes, he is. So if you pick up the book and like it, you can go onto Facebook and find him or drop a note in the Gay Mystery Thriller group.
Wonderful. Do you have anything from Recreate Tales this week?
We've just published the next book from Stan Leventhal, Skydiving in Sheridan Square. It's not a mystery. It's a literary fiction book. It's very well done. He's one of the classics writers from that time when AIDS was taking a lot of our writers. And the character, much like him, is dealing with discovering he is HIV positive.
You guys are just bringing them all out.
We are. We are. This is the third book that we've published from him. One of his books is a classic mystery, Black Marble Pool. I like it quite a bit. A music columnist ends up catching a travel writer story from his paper, ends up on vacation in Key West, where they find a dead body in the pool, the Black Marble Pool, of course, at the guest house where he's staying. And he goes out and becomes an amateur sleuth.
Jack Dixon, my guest today, you have republished three of his books.
The Jazz Anderson series, we have published all three of his books. A Scottish detective on the east end of Glasgow in the early 90s, when it was far rougher than it is now. I think it's still not the best of places, but it was particularly seedy at that time of life.
Okay, as we play the transition music from this segment to my interview section, I think I'm going to just sit here and think of Brad Pitt.
Now I'm discombobulated again. Okay.
I'll talk to you next week, Justine.
Talk to you next week.
Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. Jack Dixon is the author of 9 novels and a variety of short stories, including the Jazz Anderson Investigates series of crime thrillers set on the mean streets of Glasgow, his adopted city, and recently republished by ReQueer Tales. Since beginning his career in the 1990s, he has also dabbled in screenwriting, working on Scotland's flagship soap opera River City for several years. Jack now works as a playwright and continues to shamelessly mine the world around him to give voice to the marginalized outsiders everywhere. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Brad, and thanks for such a lovely introduction.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on. I want to begin by talking about your first book, and there's a reason I'm going to start here, and we're going to take a circular route here. Your first book was Oddfellows in 1987, correct? Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read the blurb from the book. It depicts the Glasgow gay scene in criminal underworld with an unflinching style and focuses on taboo issues, including child abuse, drug abuse, and sadomasochism. Having grown up in a small town on Scotland's west coast, did those ideas of those gritty stories in Glasgow come to you when you moved to the city, or were there things that were in your head before you even left town?
Probably, Brad, a combination of both. I'd always been a big fan of film noir. I knew instinctively that, you know, all cities still have that underbelly. And although Glasgow has got a lot better, you know, in subsequent years, back in the 80s, thanks to a certain Mrs. Thatcher, who was cutting public funds, you know, sort of council budgets were being slashed, services were being slashed. They were rearranging the whole city by putting massive motorways right the way through it. So you got communities cut in half. There was a fragmentation and just all those wonderful ingredients for any sort of noir alienation. You know, it was just completely rife. And the very first book was, I suppose, sparked off by a walk my partner and I took one night when we were staying in the East End of Glasgow, where we now still live, but the bit of the East End we were staying in then was not as smart as the bit we're staying in now. We didn't go out at night a lot, not because, you know, the mean streets of Glasgow were actually that mean, but if you've worked all day, you know, by the time you get in, you just want to relax. But this night we went out, and we went for about an hour's walk around our area, our patch. And in the space of that hour, three people tried to buy drugs from us. we saw a guy getting his head kicked in quite viciously, which was sort of really a nasty experience. Well, nastier for him, obviously, but I mean, you know, fairly striking for us to come across. And we also witnessed three young girls in very short skirts with bare legs hanging in the windows of parked cars. You know, and you don't need to be mastermind to work out what was going on there. And I thought, well, this is just going on. It's not good. It's not bad. It's going on. And what a great setting for any sort of book, particularly crime fiction. And I know that sounds merciless and hard, but I mean, I think that, you know, a lot of writers have that bit in us. You know, we see something and we just want to use it.
When you were in the small town before you moved to Glasgow, did you know that you wanted to write crime fiction?
No. Oh, God, no, no, no. I mean, I didn't have any intention of writing at all. I left the small town because my partner and I started a fashion shop. So we sold evening wear, alternative evening wear, for 8 or 9 years. We didn't do particularly well. It was a small shop, but it kept both of us in a job. You know, and then just halfway through the 1980s, thanks to Mrs. Thatcher again, of course, you know, the economy tanked, unemployment was rising, and we just couldn't survive. Small shops were going to the wall over the place. So it was after that, I thought, well, I'm reading all these not particularly good books, and somehow all these writers are managing to get into print. They're not writing about me, they're not writing about anybody I know, they're not writing about anybody who lives where I live. They're not even particularly good stories. I mean, if they can get into print, perhaps I can too. And that was my rationale, I'm afraid.
And that's how it all began.
Yep, Brad.
The reason I brought it up is you wrote Oddfellows in 87, and then your Jess Anderson series ran from 98, 99, 2000, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And then immediately following that, from about 2000 to 2003, you wrote quite a few books that were more erotic novels or erotic thrillers or mystery novels. And they all seem to have that same gritty undertone, from what I can see, as your first novel, Oddfellows.
Yes.
So in the middle of that, you had the Jess Anderson series. Is that a different tone, or is it just as gritty and harsh as the other novels?
I suppose it started off, you know, the same gritty, harsh streets. But because I did with the Jess Anderson series, as the title implies, you know, I wrote more than one, and they featured definitely Jess Anderson himself and some of his supporting cast. And it wasn't that the environment softened, and it wasn't even that Jess softened. They became a different thing, because if you're writing, I find anyway, if you're writing the same character, if your protagonist's saying the same, he's got to somehow change. You know, he's got to go on some sort of a journey, even if he goes on a circular journey, even if he ends up, you know, back where he started. And that did change them. You know, they weren't the self-contained stories that novels like Oddfellows were. So, yeah, I suppose. I mean, I would personally say that, you know, Oddfellows is still a tough read.
Who is Jess Anderson? And tell us about the journey, the change that Jess went through, the growth.
His growth, I mean, he's a cop. In the first novel, Freeform, he's a cop. He's actually he's actually employed by Strathclyde Police, although he no longer is by the end of the novel. And for the second and the third novels, he's a PI, so he's self-employed. And changes, I think, for me, and well, obviously for Jazz, the big change happens in the first book when finds out or comes up against, both in his personal life and his professional life, that there's just no one that you can trust. I don't want to put in any spoilers in case, God love us, Brad, we can persuade some of the listeners to buy the things. But he starts off okay, Jazz. I mean, he's not perfect. He's not what anybody would, he hasn't got what anybody would describe as a well-rounded life. But, I mean, he's getting on okay. By the end of that book, he's lost everything. So he's got to pick up the pieces in book two and somehow start again. But everything that happens in book two is informed by what happened to him in book one. But by the end of book two, he's got some of his hope back. But we know, and if you read book two, you'll find out this, although he's getting his hope back, it comes with a lot of baggage, and it's that baggage that Jasmine himself have got to deal with in book three.
You did a very good job of describing the series without giving too much away.
Oh, yeah.
That's the hardest part of interviewing mystery writers, is how do they tell the story and not give too much away?
We'll see.
He's very
careful. Yeah.
You have to kind of tap dance a little bit to make that happen.
Exactly, Brad, exactly.
After Jas Anderson, as I said, you went to more erotica. Is there a particular reason why you left traditional mystery? Is there something about erotica and erotic thrillers that interests you more?
Well, there always was and always is, and still is, obviously, a lot of sex in all my books. And in fact, in a way, the problem with them was they had too much story to be read as erotic novels, and they had too much sex to be read as crime novels. So you always had this uncomfortable mix. I mean, I don't think it's an uncomfortable mix. I mean, I think it works fine, but I'm sort of in the minority there, which is fine as well. It came about when, unfortunately, we'd got into book three, and book three had been published by my publisher, who I'd been with from the very start, and they announced that they were going over to porn films completely. So they always did publish porn, you know, porn stroke erotica. But they had a lot of, like, non-erotic gay fiction that they were doing as well. And it was part of that. So you know, they decided that it wasn't economical. So I found myself without a publisher. And I don't know whether you're aware over there, but an entrepreneur here called Richard Branson, he runs trains. He's got an airline. He started off having a record shop chain, and it just built and built and built. And he's got a publishing arm. So he apparently had been, I don't know, doing his market research or getting his market research done. And just about that time in the, towards the, well, just late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a big thing for gay porn over here. I mean, when I say a big thing, you know, big like proportionally, you know, but still tiny. And he decided that he was going to put out an imprint, and it was called Idol Books, A-D-O-L, Idol Books. They were openly soliciting authors, and they were openly soliciting a synopsis and a sort of chapter by chapter. And you got commissioned for three books, and you got an advance for each. And I had never really had an advance before, Brad, so, you know, I was tempted, shall we say.
I know this is about mystery, but I'm really fascinated by some of your erotica background. You published novels and short stories.
Yeah.
And you published in Bunkhouse Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not familiar with. Is that one of the gay magazines that were mostly nudes, but then had some stories in them?
Yes.
I presume that's not around any longer.
No, I don't think so. It was actually based in your part of the world.
I was pretty closeted for a while.
Sure.
I know a few of them. Yeah, Bunkhouse didn't ring a bell.
Yeah. Oh, that was so good. I got $100 and he sent me $100 in an envelope.
Just sent $100 in an envelope?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know.
One thing I'm curious about, are you seeing in your part of the world gay bookstores closing? Like, there used to be a bookstore here in Los Angeles that was called White Rabbit Books that I loved to go to.
Oh, nice, yeah.
They're gone.
Yes.
Are you seeing that happen as well?
We don't have gay bookstores, Brad. We have never had gay bookstores in Glasgow.
Oh, you never have.
You were lucky if you got a gay section. And it was a very small gay section.
Because I have a theory about the gay bookstores. I don't know. I'm going to bring it out anyway.
Yeah, sure, do.
They were great stores mm-hmm. and had some great books. But the busiest part of the stores were the magazine racks.
I bet.
And now that I look at, the internet has taken over the porn industry.
Of course, yeah.
And so there was no need to go to those magazine racks. And I've been wondering if those stores, and I should find some people that owned or worked in some of those stores during that time, and actually the ones that still do, were those magazines what actually kept them running?
Oh, see, I
so
know.
That they could have the beautiful books
yeah.
they had on display.
Yeah.
People say, well, gay people don't read anymore. But maybe they're
true.
Reading just as much as they've always had. And they're all victims of Amazon as well.
Don't start me, Brad. Don't start me.
You're probably like my daughter. She lives in Berlin and absolutely refuses to allow me to send her anything off of Amazon. I'm going to ask you about a short story that you wrote, and only because I find this funny. And it's a short story called Tripping.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's part of an anthology called Erosex Machina.
Ah, yes, yeah.
Is that?
Yes, yes.
Okay. It makes me laugh, and for one reason, I have very little judgment on how people get their kicks.
Sure.
And, you know, people like to use toys. I've used them myself.
Mm, sure.
But what's funny to me about the anthology that you were in, I'm going to read one of the reviewer's comments. If your kink happens to be the cold, hard feeling of shiny chrome against your bare skin, then this will be a joyride bar none.
Oh, nice stuff, though, yeah.
And then the blurb for the book says, eroticizing the mechanical over 25 of today's hottest writers as they explore erotic relationships with all kinds of gizmos, gadgets, and devices.
Yeah.
How did this book come about, and how did you become involved?
Well, the great thing about short stories is back when those anthologies were coming out, you could actually get anthologies commissioned. I can't actually remember how I got in touch with that guy or whether he got in touch with me. I think what it was, we'd both been in another anthology and he'd liked whatever story it was of mine that he'd read in that. And he got in touch with me and asked if I was interested in doing something for that book. And I don't know, Brad, are you familiar with the work of J.G. Ballard?
No, you've stumped me.
Have you seen the film Crash? Crash, the one that's got James Spader in it? Nope.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes.
Yes.
Yes, you are ringing the bell.
Yes. Well, yes. I always thought that book was so fucking hot, and it's such a hot film too. I mean, it's partly hot because of James Spader. But if you remember the film, there's something beautifully vacant about him, just in that film. And the whole idea behind Crash is it's about a group of people who get off on car crashes.
Mm.
I mean, interesting idea. I do not get off on car crashes. I mean, you know, I don't like cars. I'm slightly frightened of cars, you know. But there was something about the way that film was put together, and there was something about the way that actor portrayed this character who got off in that. I thought, that's hot. I don't know why it's hot. I probably don't want to think too much about why I think it's hot, but it was that short story in that anthology you're talking about that was inspired by J.G. Ballard's book Crash.
Well, I think no matter what somebody's fetish may be or turns them on, if it's written really well, regardless if it's something you have an interest in, it could still be very hot.
Oh, God, yeah. Yes, yeah.
But the only reason I bring it up is because I think there's been so many erotic anthologies written, and generally there are themes. But I've never seen one that was focused on gizmos, gadgets, and devices. So it made me laugh when I read that.
Good, but Brad, I'm glad it did. And interestingly, you have brought back a story to my mind I'd almost forgotten about. You know, and I still like that story, and I still think it works. And I got $75 for it.
Well, there you go.
Exactly.
Well, to kind of tell him myself, I met a guy who went to his place. Actually, he called me to come over to his place. Oh. And he said, I want to let you know that I'm into dress socks. And I thought, okay, that's no big deal. I can wear dress socks. I don't really care. But when I got there, and I have no idea why I'm telling you this story.
I'm fascinated.
When I got there... It wasn't just that he wanted me to wear dress socks. He wanted to sit on the bed and watch me take dress socks on and off.
Oh, wow.
On and off.
Wow.
And I'm glad he enjoyed it, but at one point I just said, you know, I'm going to go home because this just isn't working for me.
Well, it's so true, Brad, for that sort of thing to work. You know, both sides have got to be getting something out of it. Otherwise, you know, it's just putting on and taking off socks, isn't it? I mean, for hours.
Well, it certainly caught me off guard.
But yeah, so something that did always attract me about erotica, and just which probably explains why I managed to write the vast amount of it that, when I look back, I actually did write, is just the challenge of making something hot and finding a way into a subject. I mean, I think you can eroticize anything, you know, if...
That particular experience in the right hands could have been written extremely, extremely beautifully.
Yeah.
So I agree with you there. I'm going to get back to Jass Anderson, though.
Okay.
You've just been republished those three recently with Recruit Tales.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How did that come about? Did they reach out to you? Or?
Yes. I hadn't actually given much thought to the Jass Anderson books for decades, Brad. You know, I mean, it has actually been that long. And then I've got a site. Well, it's not my website. It's the Playwrights Studio of Scotland have got a website. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Scottish playwrights have got a page. And I got an email from one of the people who runs the website and saying, we've got an email for you from somebody called Requeer Tales in California. And I said, get out of here. You have no, you're making that up. But... it was those really cool guys at Requeer Tales, and they wanted to publish all three Jass books, and you could have knocked me down with a feather, Brad. You really could. And it was a wonderfully positive experience, too. They were so nice, and it just felt really good to know that somebody out there read those fucking books, because, I mean, I never sold that many books, because, as we were saying, they were always that uncomfortable mix. You know, they do have quite strong stories for people who like strong crime stories, but a lot of people who like strong crime stories don't necessarily like a whole lot of gay sex to go along with it. You know, so it always has been a slightly uneasy mix. So I was just so pleased. And I was proud as punch. I was proud as punch when those three books got reissued.
Well, not only were people still reading those fucking books, obviously they enjoyed them enough to reach out to you.
I know. God. Oh, I was... It was one of those things. It not only made my day, it made my week, and possibly made my month, you know.
So why stop at three?
Because my publisher stopped. Yeah, I would quite happily have kept writing Jass Anderson books, you know, on... And on, I actually got, and I hope this isn't too heartbreaking for anybody who's a Jass Anderson fan, I actually got a third of the way through a fourth book before I got the phone call from my publisher saying they were going to drop The Arm of Their Publishing Empire. that wasn't concerned with porn. So, you know, somewhere, possibly on a 3.5-inch disc. If you're old enough to remember them, dear listeners, there is a third of a Jazz Anderson book.
Well, there's lots of options these days, so if you ever decide to finish the rest of that novel,
I don't know whether Jazz in 2021. You know, I can't imagine what the Jazz from the Jazz Anderson books. I can't imagine what he'd be doing now. I mean, I probably could if I thought long enough about it. But yeah.
Now, I know you're very active now in screenwriting and you're doing quite a bit with that, but has there been any thought to writing any additional novels?
No, actually. Brad, I'm still so proud of all those 9 books, but it feels to me like it was something for then. Yeah. I mean, it's an age thing. I don't know whether I've got the attention span to actually commit to that sort of length of time. Yeah.
So it had its time and you're on to other things.
I mean, I'm not saying I never will.
Right.
You know, but I don't have any immediate plans, shall we say.
Well, it seems that you are much more focused on screenwriting at this time, or at least were.
Yeah.
You worked on the River City.
Yes, yes.
Soap opera.
Yeah.
Which I would think that would be fun to write for a soap opera.
Oh, Brad, no. Horrible. No. Incredibly well paid. You have no idea. Incredibly well paid. But I formed a theory about that time that there's an inverse ratio between the quality and satisfaction you get from your work and the amount that you get paid for it. So if you're getting big bucks, you know, they're compensating you for something.
What's so difficult? I know the show's been on for 20 years. Is it just difficult to come up with new storylines over that length of time, or?
Well, no. It's interesting. It was an incredible experience. I mean, I won't say it wasn't, and I was so lucky to get that chance, and it paid for my house. I mean, it's kept me solvent through, you know, a good couple of bad financial times since. But if you're a writer on the soap, you're the bottom of the heap, Brad. You really are. I mean, it's worse than screenwriting. You're the you are the dirt on someone's shoes. You really are. And you just have to churn that out. You have to churn that out, and you have to be able to make changes really short notice. You have to be able to write the things quite fast. I got a lot of work from them, and I am so grateful. If anybody to do with River City is watching this, you know, I am grateful. You know, but it's a slog. It's a really hard slog, and you're not treated well respect-wise, but you are very well financially compensated. So, you know, you've just got to, you know, be a professional.
One thing in your bio, it says you now work as a playwright and continue to shamelessly mine the world around you to give voice to the marginalized outsiders everywhere. What does that mean?
That means that I think it's important that everybody's got a voice. This is going to go downhill from here on in, Brad, I'm afraid to. I try and articulate this. There's a tendency these days in particular, but it's always been there a bit since the 1980s, and there's a tendency to homogenize things. I don't know whether it's springing from identity politics or what, but we're now all thought about as slabs of things. You know, there's the gay market, there's the women's market, there's the, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's people think of these as homogenized groups, like everybody's the same. Everybody's not the same. But the more you're presented with, you know, a nice homogenized group, the more, if you're not like that, and hand on heart, Brad, I think we'll admit that the bulk of us aren't, the more, you know, you could be tempted to feel inadequate. You could be tempted to try and change a bit of yourself. You know, but why should you? The broader the canvas, the bigger the canvas, we can get out there and just stuff with as many different sorts of people and life experiences as we can get. You know, that can only be a good thing.
My guess is when you're talking about the voiced marginalized outsiders everywhere, you've brought up identity politics and you've mentioned your favorite person, Margaret Thatcher, a few times.
Of course.
I'm presuming you get in somewhat of the political side in your screenwriting. Is that correct? Because I know you're very active politically.
Yes.
Because you said you're a lifelong socialist.
Yeah. It's actually more like, well, yeah, I am a lifelong socialist. It's been so long since we've had a socialist government here, Brad. You know, I mean, it's becoming a bit of a pipe dream. But I'm socialist in my approach, I think, too. Yeah. Obviously, we're not in power. You know, we can't make policy. But what we can do as individuals, as activists, is just, you know, sort of, I mean, it sounds pompous to say we can lead by example.
I don't know any other way to lead.
Yeah, excellent.
You say that you have worked for the local branch of the Labour Party or been active with that.
Yes, yes.
Generally, we don't get into politics, but I find it very interesting because you are so active and brought it up with some of the information you gave me. And one of the reasons I wanted to get into politics a little bit, the world in general, many of the countries becoming more conservative, some more extreme than others. The younger generation seems like they're going to change things. I'm actually somewhat conservative. I'm a conservative liberal.
Oh, sure.
Kind of mid. And my daughter went to college in England.
Oh, nice.
And I was trying to think of the name of the town. I couldn't come up with it. But she went to college in England. She's traveled throughout Europe. She's now getting her master's degree in Berlin.
Oh, fabulous.
And what she said to me just the other day, and it stuck with me reading your information that you gave me on politics. She said, Dad, you got to realize over here, Bernie would be a moderate.
Well, actually, yes, I know. I mean, I think that doesn't mean that it's particularly left-wing or socialist over here, and it doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't say anything about Bernie Sanders' politics himself. It does say, I think, that a lot of us have become a lot more conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And isn't it interesting when it happens to you and you don't realize it's happening?
Yeah, it does.
I think it makes complete sense because in a sense, the older you get, the more things become important to you. I don't mean things as in houses and cars and possessions. I just mean, you know, there's more at stake. Yeah. And I think if you have got stuff at stake, I think you will be a bit more cautious. Yeah.
You do tend to get a little more conservative when you get older. I have found that to be true. I have a brother who is very conservative. And fortunately, he saw Trump for what he was. And liked Trump from day one.
Good. He was sensible then.
Yeah, he is a sensible man. And he and I exchange a lot of articles back and forth because we disagree on issues. But we respect each other because he just has a different opinion on how things go. And he's not a nut job. But I'm finding that more and more he and I are agreeing on things.
Yes.
Oh. And I don't know if maybe he's softening it a little bit and I'm hardening it a little bit.
See? Yeah. Yes. It's interesting, though. I think the whole Trump thing, I think, gave the whole world just a huge, horrible fright. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it had a huge thing to do with the Australian election.
Yes. Yes. Interestingly, Brad, and I'd be interested in your reaction to this. There was quite a few people on the left over here when your elections were taking place, mm-hmm. and everybody was saying, you know, we've just got to hope like mad that Donald Trump goes and Biden gets in. And there were some voices here that were saying, wouldn't it be maybe better for the country and the world if Trump did get back in? And in a horrible, horrible way, you know, just continued with those awful policies and just that terrible attitude, and the American people rose up, you know, and it would be the right people outside the steps of the Capitol, not that ragtag bunch. I mean, I know it's quite an extreme thing to have to think about, but I was sort of, that gave me pause for thought. I don't know whether I agree or not.
I think there's a lot of merit to it. It's what I would call the slingshot effect.
It is, yes.
You pull it back so far, people are going to resist.
Yes.
And the pendulum swings yes. dramatically the other way.
Yes.
I'm glad that didn't happen. No, but well, I think
I am too.
That's making...
Yes, yes.
But I think there is something to that belief, yes, yep. most definitely. Well, I'm going to totally throw us for a loop here now, because I'm going to bring up something that you... probably didn't expect me to bring
up. Oh, God. Is this some awful short story you've dug up somewhere?
No, it's not that. It's probably worse than that. I want to know about Gomorrah and the Sodomites.
Oh. Everybody wants to know about Gomorrah and the Sodomites.
You were a bass player
for that. Yes, I was indeed. I was a Sodomite.
I want to hear that story.
That was in the late 1970s, early 1980s, back on the west coast of Scotland in a small town called Saltcoats. And everybody was in a band. Yeah, you know, we were just mm-hmm. all in bands. It became your social life. And I just went through band after band after band. I had a great time. I don't think any of the bands that I was ever in actually got anywhere. We used to do gigs in hotels, you know, so we did get paid, sort of. But after, you know, so years and years of that, we decided, oh God, you are going back, Brad, you're really going back into the mists of time. That was an electronic band. That was basically our vocalist and drum machine and a keyboard and me. And we just practiced in a scout hall. Yeah, because I think, believe it or not, the guy who played our keyboards was a scout, and he had the keys to the scout hall. It was just one of those things, as I'm sure you remember from your own youth. If you were in a band, you gave your band as outrageous a name as possible. You gave your band a name that would stick, and by God... How many decades on, Brad, Gomorrah and the Sodomites has been said. That title has been said.
That's why it jumped out at me. I absolutely love the name of the yes. band. And it begs the question, were you out at that time?
It was so strange. I mean, I think it was... I think everybody knew, but I had such an interesting group of... friends up at that time. You know, I mean, there was not a mainstream sexual interest in there. Yeah. You know, everybody, I'm not going to like go into everybody's sort of like particular kink, but it was just, I think if you're that age and you have a strong enough support group of your friends, I don't think you really care about what anybody else thinks. And I was completely spoiled enough to be going to Edinburgh University for 4 years. So I had a whole 4 years before I had to think about getting a fucking job. So, I mean, yeah. I don't know. Out and in, it's sort of like, I don't know. I mean, I've got opinions on that, but I mean, I don't know if we necessarily want to go there, Brad.
Well, we are reaching the end of the show.
Oh, no.
Yes, believe it or not.
And we've been having such a lovely time.
I know. This has been a good time. And I always wrap up the show with, well, I haven't always, but started it back up again with awkward questions authors get.
Oh.
And what I did is I surveyed authors and asked for questions that are difficult to ask or bizarre questions they've been asked.
Right.
And I randomly draw them.
Oh my God, right.
So hold still. And I am going to spin the wheel and we'll see what you get.
Da, 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 da.
So hold still. Here we go.
The tension.
Oh, good. This is one that I was hoping would come up soon. Is your protagonist circumcised?
No, he's Scottish. Of course he's not. Is that an actual question?
Yes, a very prominent author said that he has been asked that before.
For goodness sake. God, I mean, don't people ask the strangest things?
Well, obviously, it was important to the reader.
Well, yeah.
Personally,
yeah.
As a reader, if I had one preference to the other, I would just make it so.
Oh, yeah, I know, God. but having said that, you know, sort of strange question. These are the questions of the wonderful people that buy our books, Brad. So,
absolutely.
If they want to know about the foreskins, tell them.
At least they care enough to ask.
Yeah, boy, exactly.
So again, I have Jack Dixon, and the books are the Janice Anderson series that have been put out by Requeered Tales, and I'll have plenty of links in the show notes, as I always do. And once again, Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on today.
Brad, I had such a great time. You are a fabulous host. Thank you for talking me through it and making sure I didn't press any wrong buttons.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.